Were any of your formative crushes cartoon characters? Are any of your current crushes cartoon characters? If so, come with me and you'll be in a world of pure hot animation. I'm comedy writer and 42-year-old child, Gabby Hutchison Crouch, and I've been having cartoon crushes since Thatcher was in power. You can't Section 28 away the funny tummy feelings I had about Chitara, you daft dead Tory. Why do animated characters appeal? I want to find out with the help of some funny guests who are here to talk about the cartoons that make them want to smash cut to a wedding day fantasy scene. Will we find something out about early crushes, pop culture and sexuality, or will we just giggle about drawn-on high-cut leotards? Whatever we do, I hope it'll help you see that those idle thoughts you have about getting passed around like a dirty little tear and share by all of the Mutant Ninja Turtles is absolutely fine. Welcome to Curiously Drawn. With me this episode is an audio producer and director who helped to create titles such as Doctor Who Redacted, Eliza a Robot Story, is a voice director on Zombies Run, and has recently directed an adaptation of The Woman in Black for Audible. She and I once spent about 2 years trying to make the precursor to this podcast, at the end of which the BBC told me they wanted their microphone back. I'd say it was their loss, but I liked that microphone. It's Ella Watts. Hello.
Hello. Oh, thank you for reminding me of my workplace abuse. Oh my God.
Trauma.
Like that was, oh, good Lord. Multiple years of
non-abuse. As you probably know, I did a record with Shan. And I am hoping to do a record with Mary later on for this series as well. So at least I made some friends out of it, but it was traumatic.
I enjoyed that Shan got to celebrate her love of Knuckles, though.
Yeah, why isn't he Australian? He should be Australian. He's an echidna. Makes no
sense. Yeah, no, you are right. I'd never thought of it until you said it. I was like, oh, yeah, no, hang on. Wait. Although, I mean, I don't know, as a voice director, we often get, like, Americans getting really confused by things like Scottish accents. So maybe it was just because the American population would have struggled with an Aussie accent. Maybe. It's a wild and wacky world behind the scenes, I'll tell you that much.
I'm sure it is. So by confused by Scottish accent, do you mean that you tried to hire some American actors and they're just, like,
So it's a thing that you often have to bear in mind when you're casting for or directing something aimed at an English language audience, which is often going to be primarily American, especially in terms of like the market you're aiming at. You quite often get feedback on like strong accents that aren't American. For example, Celtic accents like Scottish or Irish, where you'll get American listeners kind of saying, oh, well, I couldn't understand what this character was saying at all. This is kind of a weird and surprising thing, but it means that it's not about not casting people, but it's about kind of saying, oh, well, are you at all able to Americanize a bit sometimes? Or that if you are going to go with someone with a really broad Scottish accent, then you're thinking about, like, why am I doing this? And you might be doing it with, like, slightly more consideration than you would with someone who's got a kind of standard East Coast American accent, because you know that by doing it, people are going to complain. So it's like, is this worth the complaint? Often it is, but it still needs to be thought about. One of my favorite stories, because I just find it so funny, about the history of the BBC is that like there was this kind of big, it's referred to historically as the battle for the soul at the BBC, which sounds very grandiose. Yes. And basically what happened was shortly after the BBC was founded, there were a lot of mining strikes. And for a week, the strikes were broadcast on the BBC. So this is in the 1920s. The miners' demands were read out on air for everyone in the nation to hear. However, Reith, for all his honourable freedom of speechness, refused to let the Northern miners speak on the radio themselves, because he said the only people who should speak on the radio are people with an Oxford accent. So he had them write letters and get them read out by Oxford presenters. And then, even though the strikes were ongoing after that first week, at the end of the week, he declared that the strikes were done and had Neville Chamberlain come on and read a letter talking about how great it is that it's all sorted out now. And then, and this is my favourite cherry on the cake, had a full choir sing Jerusalem. Which, in case you don't know, was a poem written by William Blake to inspire the English working classes to revolution. And yeah, and then that was the end of the battle for the BBC. But yeah, so for example, the BBC for a very long time only broadcast people speaking Queen's English, yes. a sort of Oxford Southern yes. accent, which was considered to be neutral. And that still has a little bit of a hangover today in a lot of voice acting and audio drama. And it's a similar thing in the US with like Northeast accents. Mm. And the kind of what's referred to in podcasting as like the NPR accent. Right. So I think it is important and good to have a variety of accents. I also think it's important and good to make sure that things are as accessible as possible. But I would say, yeah. generally speaking, the way to get around that is to provide a transcript. Sure. Sorry, cool. That was a ramble.
No, that's... I'm failing to find any way that we can make a segue from it. That's right. So your first choice is an obstinate manga and anime protagonist with a tragic backstory and, related to that, a couple of prosthetic limbs. He's short, he's rude, he's an alchemist who's also sort of a soldier. I don't really know. I'm getting all of this from the wiki because I am unfamiliar with the canon material. It's Edward Elric from Full Metal Alchemist.
Hooray! Oh my god.
Oh my god. I got things right.
No, you did. Although hey. Reading that, I got so embarrassed. I was like, oh gosh, okay, no, I am talking about this. No, you know what? Like, I have always been very open about my love of Full Metal Alchemist. I'm sticking to it. I did have a huge crush on Edward Elric, and part of me always will. So.
Tell me why.
Full Metal Alchemist is a manga series by Hiromu Arakawa that was adapted into two different anime series. The first one, Full Metal Alchemist, came out in 2003 and was released before the manga was finished. And then mm-hmm. Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, which came out later, I want to say 2010s, was after the manga was finished with the actual original ending of the manga. So right. 2003 and Brotherhood have two different endings and different plot lines because 2003 had to guess where the manga was going.
Right. This will be why my daughter has informed me that Brotherhood is better, because yes. when you'd sort of sent me these, you were having a go at me for not knowing Full Metal. my daughter is my in with all of this, with all sort of manga and anime. She is the one who recommends things to me because she knows what I like. She's a pusher. And I said to her, have you heard of Full Metal Alchemist? And she said, yes, Brotherhood is better. So we will watch it at some point.
It's incredible. It's really incredible. So it is considered to be one of the greatest anime and manga series of all time. And Hiromu Arakawa, as like a female writer and artist, is considered to be one of the greatest mangakas, which is like a writer artist of manga of all time, which is real cool. Nice to have more women up there.
Absolutely.
And she's a badass. She's like a working class woman who got into the industry from the outside. So a lot of her comics, her sort of author comics in the series, is her talking about the dairy farm that she grew up on. The series is set in an alternate universe, World War I Germany. Where basically they successfully invent alchemy, like Nicholas Flamel is right, and they create a way to transmute materials from one substance into another. And as is unsurprising, the military very quickly weaponizes this.
Yes.
And so there are state alchemists who use this for, you know, violence. And there are lots of laws around alchemy, so you can't create gold, for example, right. Because of the impact it'll have on the economy. And the other yes. thing is that what they've learned about alchemy, it's the kind of crucial thing of the series, is that you can put a certain number of materials into an equation and you'll get a certain amount of materials out. So you can't put in a kilogram of something and get out 100 kilograms. You can sure. only put in a kilogram and get out a kilogram. Mm-hmm. And for this reason, alchemists are highly educated, often scientists as well, because they have to understand the chemical composition of every material mm. in order to be able to do their magic. But also for this reason, trying to transmute a human being, trying to create a human being, is strictly illegal and forbidden because they don't know what the equation would demand. They know, you know, physically we know what makes up a human body, but if there's anything else going on, and there isn't a particular religion in the series, it's just that they, because they're a very scientific, I guess, sure. Sort of industrialized society, but they're like, but if there is anything more to consciousness, they're like, well, it might be that the equation will backfire in some terrifying way. So it's illegal.
Yeah.
And Ed and his little brother Al are two, you know, kids essentially living as very poor kind of peasant boys in rural World War I Germany, and their dad is an alchemist, a very gifted and intelligent man who, like, essentially a genius, who gets sent away to war, and their mother gets influenza and dies, and they are like 12 years old, and they are in the middle of nowhere, and there is no one who's going to be able to help them. But Ed and Al are child prodigies because their dad is a genius.
Yes.
And so they use his books to learn about what alchemy is, and they understand that a human being, the human body, is made of a measurable number of like chemical ingredients that they can get, and they try to resurrect their mother. And it backfires, right, because it turns out that, yeah, like, you can't just create a person. And instead, what they create is a homunculus. And in the process of even doing that, Ed loses his arm and leg, and Al's entire body kind of gets taken by the equation. And Ed actually sacrifices his arm to bind Al's soul to a suit of armor, to stop him from losing him entirely. And then they then go on a quest, which is the primary focus of the series, to find the Philosopher's Stone, which is a very prized object by alchemists because it allows you to create an unequal equation. So they could use it to get their bodies back. And Ed doesn't really care about getting his arm and leg back. He uses a metal prosthesis called automail, which is another really cool thing about the series. It's a lot of focus on disability. And the way that Ed is as an amputee is really well done. It's not that his amputations never affect him. Like, his prosthetics don't work as well in the cold and hurt him because metal conducts cold. Often people will try and attack specifically his arm and leg because they are the places where he is vulnerable. He needs them to be maintained and adjusted as he grows, because physically his automail needs to be adjusted and made bigger. And every time it's very, very painful, as he has to have surgery to get them reattached. Like, there's a really cool dealing of disability in the series. But yeah, like... As they go, they become determined to find the Philosopher's Stone. Ed doesn't care about getting his arm and leg back. All he cares about is getting Al's body back, because he, as the older brother, thinks that it's his fault that, you know, this all went so catastrophically wrong. And he's determined to sort of make right his mistake. So again, as child prodigies, they go for the state military kind of entrance exam for alchemists, and they pass it because they're geniuses. And they then use the money that they get from the military to... try and search for the Philosopher's Stone, but on the way they are endlessly coming up against the fact that they are now conscripted into the military, and they are being asked to do things they don't want to do as children, because as children they have a perspective on justice that's very different to a lot of the adults who've found different ways to sort of talk themselves around the moral issues they're being confronted with. Yeah, so that's kind of a summary of the series. And I mean, I guess, like, kind of like last note on that is just in terms of it just being a really good work of fiction, Hiromu Arakawa, who wrote it, she, when she was writing it, she was doing interviews with veterans from World War II. To try and make sure that this series, essentially high fantasy or urban fantasy, I guess, series that she was writing, alternate history, this alternate history she was writing was like as accurate as possible. And she kind of had a bit of a breakdown halfway through, and she was like, well, how can I write like a fantasy series that does real justice to the real things that these people actually went through? And she says in interviews that she was having this kind of breakdown to a friend of hers that she was having coffee with, and her friend said, because fiction brings salvation to characters and stories who would otherwise have no salvation at all. And that's kind of the core thesis of the series. So there's lots of characters who do bad things, and there's lots of characters who have done bad things, but the story is about what they do now, and about the fact that, like, sort of beating yourself up about the awful things you did doesn't do anything for the people that you hurt, but changing your behavior now might help other people, and that has to be enough because it's all you can do. And it's a very, very, very good series about war and peace and genocide and racism and violence and sacrifice and trauma. And I love it so much. I'm sorry, I'm aware that I've been talking for really long time.
No, that's fine. I asked you why. What's it about Edward that you like?
Oh, I feel I'm embarrassed to admit it, but it's because Ed is, you know, he's a genius. He's a troubled genius, and he's traumatized, and he's loving, and he's fierce, and he's furious. And like, when we get introduced to him, in the 2003 series, which was the first version of Fullmetal Alchemist that I consumed, I have watched and consumed all of Full Metal Alchemist in all its forms, because I'm in love with Ed. but when we meet him, he's essentially taking down a false priest, and he gets really, really, really angry at this man who's trying to play God, who's pretending to do right. miracles, because Ed is like, because I played God. And it didn't fucking work, so fuck you. And he gets really angry at the way that this fake priest is manipulating. There's this girl called Rose who this priest is manipulating. And Ed gets really angry about the fact that Rose is being misled and told that essentially her fiancé is going to get resurrected. And Ed's like, he's not. He's really not. I promise you he's not. And I'm sorry. I know you don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, nothing I say is going to convince you because you would prefer to live in a lie, but you can't. You just can't. You have to get up and move on. And he can be like very tough love like that, but it's coming from a place of incredible compassion and justice and a sense of bravery. And he's very often the character in the series who, when something awful happens, like in the military, or he finds out about something, he's so furious, and he will like call it out and confront it in a way that no other characters will, because he's just like, no, that's just wrong. Like, you're lying, you're being a coward, you're creating these excuses, but actually you did something awful. I know you have to live with that. And he has just, yeah, this fierce sense of justice. He's an amazing fighter, and I really like anime characters who are really good at combat, and Ed can do like, you know, like kind of somersaults in the air and stuff. He's like amazing kind of like karate. He always like wins kind of fights and stuff. And then he also, a friend of mine has said that my type in fiction is broken boys and brunettes who can kick my ass. And that, like, that is the case. And Ed is very broken. There's a bit where Ed gets completely impaled and then he's just really injured and has to heal himself for a long time. Oh. And I want to nurse him back to health. You know, he lost his mom. He lost everything. He's so haunted by what he's done. He's like, he has this like arrogance and humor, but what you very quickly see. So in the first episode of Brotherhood, like the episode is very much about how Ed pretends to be this like celebrity boy genius, got into the military, youngest person to ever pass the state alchemist exam. And then as the episode goes on, like kind of what's revealed is that this is a very thin facade, because in reality, he hates himself. He hates himself. And he is a genius, and he is incredibly gifted, and he actually is a deeply good person, but he he's sort of, I guess like another thing that I really love about him is the way that he sort of, he sacrifices himself to that immorality. Like, he refuses to let his younger brother Al, Alphonse, do the things that he does. Ed is so determined that he's like, well, I have to be a dog of the military, but that doesn't mean that you do. And there's a bit where, so Winry is the girl he's in love with, and it's great. She's an automail engineer, so she's the person who created his prostheses.
Sure.
She's created a lot of prostheses for people because of the war. And she's a genius in a completely different way. She's an incredible mechanic. And she's always like, they have a great kind of childhood friends to lovers mixed with a kind of Beatrice Benedict thing, where like they're always arguing. They think they hate each other. They're clearly in love. And as you watch the series, they go from like 14-year-olds who like hate each other in inverted commas, but are obviously obsessed with each other. And then like, as it goes on, it just becomes more and more like, no, they love each other. They just don't know how to say it. Winry was their neighbor when they were kids, and she and her grandma like ended up kind of taking them in when their mom died. And she's always so upset that when they leave, and she always wants them to come back. But part of the reason they leave is because Ed is so determined to not let Winry gets sucked into like all of this awful violence that he's seeing and all of these terrible injustices that he's being exposed to. And there's one episode where she comes to the city to where the headquarters of the army are based and tries to visit them, and they get attacked by a serial killer who's targeting state alchemists.
Yeah.
And it's terrible, and Ed is really badly hurt, because he's often hurt because there's a lot of whoop in this series. And Winry has to pick up a gun. And the thing with her is that her parents were doctors who fought in essentially an Iraq war in the late 1800s. Right. And they were both killed and it's not clear whether they were killed by the kind of fantasy Germany or not, because like they were giving medical treatment to all sides. But Winry has always been like, and with her automail stuff, like she's not a doctor, but she does provide prostheses for people. She's very much in the business of healing people. And Ed is going to get murdered by this like serial killer who's just destroyed one of his prostheses, and he's in a lot of pain. And she picks up a gun to try and like threaten this serial killer to try and get them to leave, you know, her best friend alone. And the serial killer leaves because at that point the military turns up and backs them up. And Winry just has this breakdown where she's just holding this gun, shaking. Mm. But there's this amazing, like, incredibly romantic moment where Ed puts his hands over hers, or puts his hand over hers, and kind of holds her and, like, gently takes the gun away from her. And it's like, your hands are made for healing. You don't have to do this. You're not supposed to hurt someone. And she just breaks down crying. And he's witty and he's funny and he's hot. He's hot.
That is absolutely fair enough. He sounds hot. I will watch it at some point. Yes. You told it to me. Let's move on to another person who is just straight up hot. So your second choice is at the same time a teen mom and a lesbian power couple in herself. She's two aliens, she's one alien, she's a third of a massive alien, she's various precious stones, she's British for absolutely no reason, she can see the future and she sings like a freaking angel while kicking alien ass. She's Garnet from Steven Universe!
Yay!
Oh, I love Garnet so much.
I just want her to pick me up. You know that like pose where like you have like a big person pick you up and you kind of sit on like their elbow, like kind of thing, and they're just like throwing it. That's what I want from Garnet, and then I want to kiss her cheek. I love her so much. She's so hot. She's so cool. And then, you know what's also great about her, though, is they're like, okay, so like she's beautiful, right? And she's perfect. But like then as the series goes on, you find out she's also vulnerable and she also like has her own like anxieties and insecurities. And then that really makes her perfect. Because you know, like a perfect character isn't the hottest, because if they know they're perfect, if they have no flaws, that's a problem. But for me, the moment
does seem initially to be like, because she's so cool. She's voiced by if you haven't watched it, good grief. It's basically about a boy and his lesbian space aunt. It's about a boy who's got all these powers, and all of his powers are his mother's powers, so they're all like healing, caring powers. It says a lot about providing boys with an alternate powerful masculinity that's to do with being a nurturing, caring, healing, kind person. It's just gives such good role models to boys. And it's got so many amazing female characters in it, because all of the gems are, they're aliens, but they take female form, and there's so many really, really cool characters in this. And yeah, Garnet is one person, but she's also two people, because you can get things called fusions when two gems basically create a relationship. It doesn't always have to be a romantic relationship, but in Garnet's case it is. And they, two smaller gems can become one bigger gem. So Garnet is her own person, but she's also a marriage. She's also Ruby and a Sapphire, who are small and feel useless. But when they're together, they become this great, powerful thing. And there's a lot of, because she is two people, sometimes she will argue with herself. And that's where the vulnerability comes from, when she argues with herself and falls out with herself and splits into the two people again.
There's that. And then there's also, she can see the future, but she isn't always sure what the best thing to do with the future is. And she has this like enormous anxiety that she is this like cool badass, but she also kind of becomes responsible for like her essentially other two partners and her child. And she doesn't always know what the right thing is to do. And she gets anxious and she has this like enormous sense of like, I think, pressure on her. There was a really amazing moment in the first season at the end where Garnet sings this song. I don't know what the song's actually called, but where she sings about being made
stronger,
of love.
Stronger than you.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead and try and hit me if you're able. Can't you see that my relationship is stable? I can see you hate the way we intermingle, but I think you're just mad because she's single. And you're not gonna stop when we wait together. We are gonna stay like this forever. If you break us apart, we'll just not make you up. And we'll always be twice the gem that you are.
Oh, And I cried. I rewatched that so many times. Because, you know, like, as a queer woman, I'd never seen queer women on television, but certainly not in cartoons. And it's just, she's beautiful. And there's also a, in the later seasons, she kind of mentors Stevoni a lot, which is the fusion of Steven and his best friend Connie, best friend slash crush. There's a episode where she kind of talks about like mindfulness and essentially therapy. And she sings this beautiful song about like calming kind of your inner anxiety. Take a moment, remind yourself to take a moment and find yourself. Take a moment to ask yourself if this is how we fall apart. And I straight up use that song to like deal with my own anxiety. She's just I love her in her pastel pink version, which is when we kind of flash back to when Ruby and Sapphire first fell in love. Mm-hmm. And I love her in her season one version when she's like, you know, all this like badass, mysterious space woman. Yeah. I also love what a dork she is. She is such a dork. She loves Steven so much, and she will humor all of his jokes so hard. Like, she will always play along with the bit. She will always commit to the bit. She is the sense of humor in that house a lot of the time. Like, I mean, obviously Amethyst is too. But like, I love that she's just this nerdy, anxious, powerful, beautiful, like queer character. And all I want to do is like just give her a massage and take her to the beach and give her a cocktail and tell her that she doesn't have to be in charge anymore and it's okay. And I'm here to just make her feel good and we can watch like some dumb, funny movie and have a good time and cuddle and. Also,
she's great because she becomes the de facto leader because they've lost their leader, and she is. She's not according to the culture that they come from. She's not supposed to be because they don't. They look upon two different gems fusing. That is definitely a metaphor for homophobia on our world. They look at her relationship. The Sapphire and Ruby relationship that creates Garnet as something that is disgusting to them. So she's not supposed to be, and then she becomes the sort of the de facto leader of this sort of rebel army. It's an army of three, and they're also looking after a kid.
But it used to be much bigger, and like that's another really cool thing about her is that she is like this veteran of this massive space war. Like she's essentially like a retired revolutionary who is now kind of like a retired immortal superpowered revolutionary. I mean, what's not to love? Also, like you mentioned, you kind of referenced like obviously some of the bigger plot stuff, and I do want to say like another thing that's really cool about Steven Universe is the fat representation. Like Steven and his mom are both fat, and they are both beautiful, and they are both like shown as being desirable. Yeah, exactly. I mean, Rose Quartz is also obviously so beautiful, and Mystery Girl, who is in one episode. I was at a Comic-Con and I saw someone cosplaying as Mystery Girl, and I asked them if I could like pose with them for a photo, and they pretended to give me their number, and I was fully blushing. I was just like chin to ears, like, oh my god, I'm getting a blush just thinking about it. Mystery Girl's so hot. Like, also, just side note, oh my god.
I love the Mystery Girl storyline. I love the she gives Pearl her, so Pearl is, oh, I love Pearl because I love a really anxious character, so Pearl is even more anxious than Garnet, and she has always been in love with Rose, who is now gone, and so Mystery Girl has got a lot of Rose energy. She's got the pink hair and she's got all this sort of confidence.
She's big and strong and fat also.
And she gives Pearl her phone number, and Pearl's like, well, I should get a mobile telephone. And then Paul becomes really excited that she has my cell phone. And she specifically went out and bought a mobile phone because she had been given a hot girl's number. And I think that's so cute.
I love Pearl's outfit in that episode. She has like a leather jacket and it's so good. And also the my other favorite Pearl outfit is in the one where they go away to the city when Greg wins like a competition and she sings a song about... Yeah, her tux. And also the song that she sings about Rose. And
That song is heartbreaking.
It destroys me every goddamn time.
The pain in that line and she's gone.
It's over, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't it over? It's over, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't it over? You won and she chose you. She loved you and she's gone.
It gets you. That is just the pain in her voice for this love that was always one-sided and now just it is a song of acceptance, but it's a song of accepting that it still hurts.
Yep. 1,000%. Yeah, and also obviously Estelle has an incredibly sexy voice. Like I am a queer woman and I had a crush on Estelle's voice from like the song that she had that was in the top 10 for ages. Was it like American Boy, I think?
American Boy that she sang completely by herself and nobody else was on that song.
Well, like, hey, listen, I only remember the bit with Estelle. I don't even remember any other voices. Like but I genuinely don't. I spent all summer singing that song, but only the bit that Estelle sang. Yeah. And God, it is so curvy, and she has really nice thighs, and she wears like a skin tight outfit, and she's hot.
She's hot. So we'll move on from one really good ensemble show to another. And your third choice is amazingly the first character we've had from this world, which I can only put down to this podcast not having had many younger people on it so far. She's only 14, but she's already that one mom friend to everybody, including her own older brother. She's the South Pole sweetheart who can waterbend, icebend, bloodbend, and definitely tearbend. Yip, yip, it's Katara of the Southern Water Tribe from Avatar Legend of Aang. So this cartoon is so good. So it's something that I kind of got into through my daughter, which has become like a big theme for anything that was made in the last 20, 25 years. It's like stuff that I got into via my daughter. But it is so good.
It is one of the greatest animated series of all time. Certainly of the 20th century.
It's an amazing story, an amazing world.
I should say certainly of the 21st century, but no, it really, really is. It's so well done. And so actually I have a whole backstory with this. So, I'm really sorry that I didn't pick Zuko because I'm one of the very few Avatar fans who doesn't have a crush on Zuko, but I will discuss this with you because I agree he's hot. So it's like, I have a whole thing about this. But so growing up, I had a really like difficult home life growing up. One of the things was that I wasn't allowed to like watch cartoons and stuff. And I was also a scholarship kid at a private school. So we at home, we like had just like Freeview and stuff. But a lot of the kids I was at school with had things like Sky, which meant that they could record TV shows. Yeah. So my friend's younger brother got into Avatar. And I really liked Avatar, but I could only watch it when I was at their house. And he used to, behind his parents' backs, record Avatar for me so that when I went round, I could catch up on it. So we would sneak out to like another room. Yeah, no, it was the best. Like he was, do you know what? Like genuinely, Will Atkinson, I appreciate you.
Just such
a legend. So we would like sneak out into another room and I would catch up on Avatar with him. And we would like, and we were so invested, it was the best. And I loved this series because like I said, I wasn't really allowed to watch cartoons. I wasn't allowed to read like fantasy books. I did both of these things anyway, but it was always kind of like difficult to do and kind of forbidden. And I had to do it in secret. And Avatar just like changed like the way that I thought about stories, right? You know, there's so much about it that's so interesting, like with the pacing, with the characters, mm-hmm. with the way that they handle morality. And I became completely obsessed with it. Also because, I'd always been into kind of like anime and manga stuff. And then like, you know, it obviously it's this highly East Asian inspired series.
Yes.
And fun fact, because my nan, this is kind of a tangent, I'm not going to go too long, but like my nan has worked a lot with indigenous nations from around the world. Right. And as part of that, she worked a lot with Tibetan monks. And in thanks and recognition of that, the Dalai Lama had a sand mandala made in Britain to thank like Britain for their help of like Tibetan monks, but specifically had it done at my nan's house because of the work that she specifically had done. And so when I was like 6 years old, I was just spent a lot of time with a bunch of Tibetan monks for like a weekend, and showed them Star Wars and gave them blackberries. And but like, so Aang being this Tibetan monk with like these yes. clothes that I recognized, like, was really fascinating and intriguing to me. So I was just like, I was obsessed. But then, like I said earlier, my type in fiction is like broken boys and brunettes who can kick my ass. And Katara is very much in the latter category. Yes. Like, she's so cool. And it bugs me because I think that like a lot of people don't realize like how cool she is, because there's a lot of other great characters. And so people don't always necessarily have a crush on her, but like, she's so hot. She's so beautiful. And I had this whole thing where, you know, like Aang has a crush on Katara throughout the series.
Yeah.
I often had this thing as a baby bisexual where like I would be in the shoes of the male protagonist right. who had a crush on a female. And so I wouldn't even notice that there was a male protagonist. I'd be like, yeah, I mean, he's right. She is the most beautiful woman who's ever existed. Like, I don't understand why everyone keeps like talking about this as if it's a thing. I'm also very autistic. So I was just confused. I was just like, this is a statement of fact. She is beautiful and like incredible and the best girl ever, obviously. Mm. And then I think like the moment that really I was like, so I always had a crush on her because she was just, I mean, she was so cute and funny and pretty and like badass. And like, I'm actually like clutching my hands to my chest just thinking about her because like, I just, her pretty blue eyes, and I love her hair loops.
Yay.
I love her hair loops. But also, the moment where I think it became like true love is she has a couple of great outfit changes. One of them is when she's the painted lady.
Yes. So,
oh my God. Like, she's like, I swear to goodness, I was writing like a lot of fan fiction and like my own original fiction at the time, you know, I was like 14. And I swear, like in everything I wrote, there was always after that a character who had like very elaborate face makeup just because of this one scene where I was just like, that is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. But also like when she has her Fire Nation outfit, she has like the crop top. And then when she fucking blood bends,
the bloodbending. It's such an interesting take they do with it. So for the first two series, the water tribes are kind of portrayed as one of the sort of the gentler people, because you've got the earthbenders who obviously, if you can fling rocks around, that's dangerous, and the firebenders who are obviously, if you can fling fire around, incredibly dangerous. And then there's the airbenders, and Aang's the only one that in that world because there's been a genocide. And then there's the water tribe who are very much the sort of the certainly the Southern Water Tribe are very poor. They've been oppressed a lot, and they can waterbend, which is seen as being sort of quite a gentle ability. And then the logic goes that if they can blend water, humans are mostly water, and that they can bloodbend, they can control people. There are some waterbenders who can control people like puppets, and because Katara is incredibly skilled waterbender, or she certainly is towards the end of it, because, you know, she goes on a journey of discovery and of learning herself along with Aang, and she develops this ability to bloodbend.
Once you perfect this technique, you can control anything or anyone.
But to reach inside someone and control them? I don't know if I want that kind of power.
The choice is not yours. The power exists. And it's your duty to use the gifts you've been given to win this war. Katara, they tried to wipe us out, our entire culture, your mother.
and it's so dangerous. You realise at that point that waterbenders might be the most dangerous out of all of the abilities.
Katara is the last bender of her tribe because they've suffered an attempted genocide, and they've like managed to survive, but there's like a dozen of them. And then Northern Water Tribe, like, people are very scared of, but they, I mean, honestly, straight up, they suffer both from the fact that they're isolationist and also because of the sexism within their culture. And then waterbending seems very gentle because waterbending is the only form of bending that can heal. Waterbending is the only bending that you can use for healing purposes. Whereas, yeah, like you say, like, they all have like different cultures, but then finding out that like that the flip side of the coin of that healing is that like also they can destroy. And also, like, one of the really cool things about Katara is, like you say, she gets better and better at bending as the series goes on. So you've got Toph, who is like the greatest earthbender of all time. Like, love literally, her. She just is. I obviously we love
she's
her.
She's introduced she's introduced in a fighting ring, this tiny little 12-year-old blind girl just throwing grown-ass men around. It's amazing.
It's so good. But then, like, the fact that by the end of the series, Katara is, like, a terrifying foe for even the most dangerous Fire Nation opponents. I mean, she defeats Azula. Like, Katara has become such an exceptional bender and such an exceptional combatant that like anyone is frightened of trying to go one-on-one with her. And like, it's so cool the way that she so creatively uses like water and ice and steam. And she thinks about like all of the different ways that she can manipulate water. Like, she's such a creative thinker. Like, I think I am really attracted to like clever characters and specifically like kind of clever characters who are also fighters. So, you know, Edward Elric is the other example. Like, and what Ed and Katara have in common is that they're both like really, really smart. They have an incredibly strong sense of justice and also they can kick your ass. She could so easily be cruel. She could so easily be a force for destruction and be consumed by a sense of vengeance. And she fights so hard to like stay on that line. And it's something that actually really takes me off, because a lot of people will say about Avatar, oh, well, Katara is like really like kind of like weak water and diluted. And it's like, okay, so first of all, I'm not sure that you notice all of the incredible feminist victories we got in that series, where Katara at no point ever lets anyone walk all over her. So like, how fucking dare you? But second, like, she's not weak. Like, specifically, you know what? Like, Ursula Le Guin would disapprove. Like, here's the thing. There is a patriarchal standard of strength for characters and narratives that says if they trample all over other people and refuse to extend compassion, then they are a strong and clever person. And if they listen to people and have feelings, and although they are powerful, choose not to do harm, then they're weak and spineless. And you know what? That's a really gendered dichotomy.
She is so caring.
She is, and that is powerful.
Yes. Absolutely. She's when I say that mom friend, I do not mean that as an insult. She is the mom friend.
I mean, you are a mom, so I assume. Yeah, exactly.
she is the mom friend, and in that she is the leader. She's the soul of that group. She's the heart of that group. And that's where so much of her strength comes from, and that gives so much strength to the rest of the group.
Yeah, truly. Like, she takes responsibility. Like, the thing that you have to remember is that they are children. Yeah. And Katara takes these awful, awful things that have happened to her. And A, she packs it all away, which is not massively healthy, but I'm glad that she works it out. But B, like, she fight, like, she is, again, she's a revolutionary hero. I've also got such a thing for revolutionaries. But, like, she is a revolutionary. Like, she holds, like, hope and inspiration, and she so fiercely refuses to like win on bad terms. Like, there's several points in the series which I think are really interesting, where she's very tempted to specifically hate the Fire Nation, right? For good reason, because they murdered her mother. But also as she meets like civilians and just members of the Fire Nation, you know, it is the kind of thing of like, and I'm sorry to reference the World Wars again, but, you know, the thing that people say, which is that Germany was the first country invaded by Hitler. Like, there were a lot of German civilians, specifically, for example, the Jewish and queer civilians, who were German. who were suffering. And so, like, the idea that Germans are evil or the Fire Nation is evil is a deeply flawed, obviously, premise. And so the fact that, like, Katara goes through that and then Katara's like, okay, so, like, the way we're going to win is not by doing genocide. The way we're going to win is by, like, inspiring people and convincing them and persuading them and fighting when we have to, but also listening. And, like, that takes such an incredible amount of, like, courage and willpower and, like, strength of spirit that she, like, develops throughout the series.
I think it's that third series that makes it really great. So the first series is fine. It's a fantasy adventure where they go from the South Pole to the North Pole and they meet people along the way. The second series brings in such cool characters and you see more of the world and you get to spend a little bit more time and you get some really interesting segues. But the third series is where they specifically go to the enemy nation. They go to the Fire Nation, who have been treated as a sort of very Star Wars-y, the sort of imperial bad guys. They go to that land and they infiltrate and they start seeing those people as human. And I think that humanizing them gives a power to them, because if a sort of evil army are just like a faceless evil army, then it almost sort of gives the evil army an out by saying, oh, these people aren't even human, they're just doing bad things. By sort of showing them as humans, and they are doing terrible things, but they're doing it because they've been for 100 years they've been taught that everybody else is inferior to them, and they're bringing civilization to, you know, to these inferior humans. By humanizing them, it adds to the world so much. And it sort of, you've got that scene where they're tricking the Fire Nation by saying, oh, everybody come to the cargo deck because it's somebody's birthday. And one of the characters goes, I can't believe the captain remembered my birthday. That's just giving them humor and giving them humanity. It almost sort of shows you that there's more at stake. And yeah, there's something really revolutionary about that series, about going, let's look at the enemy as humans and how do we get them to stop doing bad things.
It's such a good counter-imperial narrative, you know, this idea that you can be a person and you can be a part of an empire doing bad things, and also trying to reduce your country's enemies to they're all just evil one-dimensional creatures is a really good way to justify genocide. But not anything else. And also the way that, like, empire deprives you of culture. It doesn't give you culture, it takes it away. It kind of squashes it and dilutes it and compresses it into something tame. It domesticates your culture. It doesn't free your culture or celebrate it. And I think a really cool way that that's illustrated in Avatar is there's a scene where Aang, for reasons, was basically frozen for 100 years. So he remembers what this world was like 100 years ago. And when they go to the Fire Nation, he's like, oh, well, you guys all must love this dance that was, like, really popular. The thing about the Fire Nation is everyone dances. And everyone's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Because the Empire has stolen dancing from them. Because that doesn't serve a highly militarized genocidal empire. And so Aang kind of reteaches them this really important dance that, like, used to be incredibly popular in their culture. But then later on, when Aang and Zuko are trying to learn about firebending and they're learning from the firebending masters, and kind of in each of the countries, the firebending masters are an animal that has some sacred relationship with the elements. And in the Fire Nation, it's dragons. But specifically what the dragons teach them is how to dance. Like, and that's what's the core of the Fire Nation. Like, that's what the Fire Nation actually had. It's a fantastic series. It's a really fantastic series with many fanciable characters. I mostly fancy the women. I also really fancy Suki. I also really fancy Ty Lee. Just women who can kick my ass. Women who can kick my ass. In Ty Lee's case, it's I love a bubbly cheerleader type, and she can also kick my ass, which makes her perfect. And Suki, Suki could, like, lift me up. I'm pretty sure, like, she could lift me off the ground. She's so strong. I just realized I also talked about Garnet lifting me. I just like the idea of strong women.
That's absolutely fine. That is absolutely fine to have a type.
I buff women, you know?
Yeah. I mean, quick shout out to Prince Zuko, who I have mentioned on this podcast before, because I honestly believe he's responsible for a lot.
He's
an archetype of the troubled emo boy with, in this case, and also that he's an antagonist who goes through just the most amazing arc of reconciliation and rehabilitation. It's just, and it's that his arc is so earned. It goes on for so long. It starts at the end of series one, and he doesn't really become fully rehabilitated until about two-thirds of the way through the last series. It's a very long arc where he stumbles on the way, and he makes mistakes, and he corrects those mistakes. And he is an incredible character for somebody who is introduced as quite a one-note villain.
But they are seeding it from the first episode.
It's there from
the first episode. Because, like, with the way that Iroh interacts with him, with the way that they animate their expressions, like, it's there from the start. Like, he is the archetype of, like, you know, the bad boy you have a crush on. And what's so great about him is he's the archetype of the bad boy you have a crush on, but he actually is a healthy option. Like, it's like that they disguise a healthy romance prospect with, like, the cover image of, like, the bad boy, but then they're like, but actually, young girls, you could have someone who respects you and treats you kindly, and you should demand better. And I like the fact that, like, Avatar does that a couple of times in terms of, like, the tiny baby lessons that they've got for the teenagers watching, where, like, Jet is a bad boyfriend because he treats Katara badly, and Zuko is actually good, but it's good that Mei is able to, like, have boundaries with him.
Yes, definitely.
And yeah, there's a couple of, like, moments like that. And, like, Aang and Katara go from, like, Aang kind of being just, like, not making sense for Katara at the time to, like, by the end of the series, you're like, oh no, this makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I also, like, hey, listen, this is very basic of me, but I did really hard ship Aang and Katara. I think because I was just very young when I started watching it, but also because, like, Aang is a cool person. Like, one of the people on my shortlist for this, as we've discussed, I have so many cartoon crushes. It was Yo Asakura, and Yo is a lot like Aang, because both of them are kind of, like, seemingly happy-go-lucky kind of protagonists, but underneath are dealing with a lot. I love a character with a facade. I love a character with a facade. I love anyone who's like, ah, no, don't worry, everything's fine. Actually, I'm horribly traumatized. Like, yeah, that's so much my type, which is terrible, but it really is.
Aang is a great character. They're doing a film where they're all young adults, which I'm so excited about.
Really excited
to see them in their early 20s.
Oh my god, me too.
Happy days.
What we learned from the character design of Legend of Korra is that Aang did grow up into being quite a dilf. And I'm really satisfied with that. Like, I'm so pleased that
what
that happened.
Is that one picture that somebody took of him as, like, in his 30s, and he's pulling exactly the same goofy pose as one that he pulls when he's 12, and that just delights me.
Yes, also, obviously, Zuko aged like a fine wine.
Obviously, he did.
And Katara is my wife. Like,
absolutely.
What else do I need to say? Katara is my wife. There is no version of her that it is not beautiful to me. She's my beloved.
Let me finish off with one last question for you, which is that if we could take one of these three characters out of cartoons and make them a real flesh and blood human being, whom would you pick, and would you try to romantically pursue them?
So I've been thinking about this, right, because I knew that this question was coming, and I think I know the answer, but I want to talk you through my thought process.
Okay.
So, Ed actually does come to our world in a film of Fullmetal Alchemist called Conqueror Shambhala that most people haven't watched, but I watched because I desperately wanted more Fullmetal Alchemist. And it's really interesting because obviously in our world, alchemy doesn't exist. And so in our world, and we don't have Orsamail, which are these very sophisticated prosthetics, which they have in their world. So in our world, he is a person who has two prosthetics and a lot of highly specialized academic knowledge that he can't use.
Right.
And so he is like, he's still himself, but he's very sad. And also Ed loves his family. So I would not bring out Ed here because he would be so unhappy and furious. He would be furious with me. Like, he wouldn't be violent, but he would be very upset. So I wouldn't do that. Garnet obviously is taken by herself. And also, if I brought Garnet here, then that would sort of mean subjecting the Earth to an alien invasion.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'm like, I would feel bad for that. So I think Katara. I think Katara. Now, obviously, Katara does, I mean, by the time she's my age, she's like, on her way to having a family. So that's like a little bit tricky. But let's say it's before that happens. And I would say Katara because I want to see if she can do bending here, because that would be really cool. Like, if you met someone who actually had, like, what would we call it? Like, hydrokinesis. Like, that would be
incredible.
So fucking amazing. I would love that. And also because I think Katara deserves a holiday. And I would very happily be her, like, spring fling, you know? Like, if you can wave your magic wand and let her go home, but I can just be, like, her lesbian spring fling that she has before she gets married. And, like, she can just have a good time. Like,
Let her enjoy indoor plumbing for a bit.
Exactly. Like, and I just, and also, like, her not having, again, I've got this, I've realized in the course of this episode, I've got this real thing for, like, women who are, like, in control and leaders, and I just want to give them time off. I just want her to not feel responsible for 20 seconds, you know? I want to take her to a movie and, like, give her a massage. I've got to think about giving women massages also. Not messing with that.
That sounds amazing. Have you got any projects you'd like to shout out about before we go?
Yeah, so please check out Zombies Run, which is the app where I work as a voice director. It's an immersive audio drama and fitness app, and essentially 9-season zombie apocalypse soap opera. It's got loads of really cool queer characters who all have official art. So if you are attracted to cartoon characters, then I strongly recommend Zombies Run, where you can have a romance with several of them. And also check out my podcast series, which is a very different tone, but I made a podcast series called Eliza, a Robot Story, which is a near future sci-fi about domestic abuse. And I know that that sounds miserable, but it is a very hopeful and kind series starring Tanya Reynolds, which has, like, lots of elements of humor in it as well. And it's really important. It's very much about, like, learning about how we can be more kind to one another and listen to survivors and also recognize kind of red flags in our relationships. And I just really want more people to listen to this because I think it's good to listen to it. So please do check that out if you are in a good mental place. We've got content warnings on every episode, so you can check in before you listen. But I do think it's worth it. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much, Ella.
Thank you.
Huge thanks to Ella Watts. For more credits and details, see @curiously_drawn on Twitter.